Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
The vibrant energy of Manhattan is so extraordinary that old photographs of it are literally hard to believe. For much of the 19th century, parts of this small island were still given over to farming. Alexander Hamilton built a country estate on Manhattan in 1802. And Edgar Allan Poe penned The Raven from the tranquility of a farmhouse along what today is West 84th Street, replete with movie theaters, restaurants, and $10 million townhouses in 2015. Stranger yet, before the best views of the island came from the windows of skyscrapers, one could get them by scrambling up steep, rocky outcrops that rose several stories from street level. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. It all changed, of course, through the efforts of urban planners who plotted and paved a strict plan of rectangular blocks which have been both loved and hated for more than a century, but which certainly helped make the city we know today. The new book by author Gerard Coppell is called City on a Grid: How New York Became New York. Gerard, welcome to Think.
Hey, Chris. Great to be with you.
You started thinking about the streets that make up New York after the 9/11 attacks that destroyed the World Trade Center. A smaller facility has been rebuilt in the same spot, and when that happened, old streets literally reemerged.
Yeah, you know, one of my favorite intersections of so-called old New York was the intersection of Greenwich and Dey Streets, which is way downtown. I only knew that intersection through a painting that was done in 1810 of that intersection, a beautiful little watercolor, showing a mother helping her child take water from a street pump at the corner. And when the original World Trade Center was built, that intersection of Greenwich and Dey Streets went away. The footprint of the original World Trade Center was very large. Well, I suppose you might say it's one small upside from the events of 9/11, but with the smaller footprint of the new World Trade Center, lo and behold, that intersection of Greenwich and Dey reappeared. And I was able to go to that intersection and stand where that image took place back in 1810. And so it was, you know, shortly after that, a number of years ago, when I started thinking about, maybe the streets of New York, of Manhattan especially, are more plastic than I imagined. Street corners come and go and come back again. Now, that section of Manhattan is below the grid, and I wasn't quite yet thinking about the grid. But then I thought, okay, well, let's say, maybe I thought a little morbidly, I don't know. Let's say it wasn't the World Trade Center, but it was the Empire State Building. And not at an edge of the island, but in its emotional and physical heart.
Yeah.
And let's say instead of coming straight down, it fell over on its side for whatever reason. How would we rebuild? Would we reconstruct the grid that was created in 1811? And obviously we'll talk a little bit about its creation, you know, as we move along here. But would we rebuild this rigid rectilinear grid of many parallel cross streets and a dozen or more parallel avenues perpendicular to them? Or would we rebuild something that is more appropriate, say, to life in a modern city, where we want to minimize surface transportation congestion, we want to add some green space, we may want to add water features. And that got me thinking, okay, well, let's take a look and see how this grid came to be. And that's sort of the origin story of this book.
Before we get there, I want to ask what you learned about the history of comprehensive urban design, because it would seem like old world cities really took shape around what happened to exist there rather than building up within the confines of sort of preordained streets.
Yeah, I mean, and there are so many different ways that cities start. I mean, most European cities that exist today started as defensive centers. Mm-hmm. They had walls around them, and eventually as peace generally broke out, they got beyond those walls and expanded. But generally, as a very general rule, European cities are round and expand out from the middle. Manhattan, we can actually even go back to Spanish colonial cities. you know, the grid first originated, as all things in the Western world do, with the Greeks. They started planning certain gridded cities back in 400 BC or so. And the Romans used them to some extent. And then grids sort of go away in Europe. But in Spanish colonial cities in the Americas, the Spaniards build essentially gridded cities, rectilinear streets. But interestingly, they put squares in the middle of them, big parks around which were sited all the official buildings. And there are a number of cities like that in what are now the United States.
That's Santa how we do it Fe. In Texas. Yeah.
Yeah, right. And that basically started with the Spanish so-called Law of the Indies, which ordained how Spanish colonial cities were supposed to be constructed. And Santa Fe, Albuquerque, even the original downtown of Los Angeles, which was originally a Spanish city. So there are many ways that cities are made. And New York, in a sense, was like Boston. They were port cities, and their original development was on no plan at all, essentially a sprawl from the commercial waterfront. And, you know, if some listeners are familiar with Boston, they'll know that Boston never really got itself organized. but it has a wonderful public transportation system. And Manhattan, or New York City, which was Manhattan until 1898, it spread out into the five boroughs after that. Manhattan, the city pretty much grew very haphazardly until the early 1800s when it was decided to give a commission of three people the power to come up with whatever plan they wanted for the entire island. And I'll just note that at this time, early 1800s, the city is about 60,000 people, all living below what is now Chamber Street. Many listeners may not know what that is, but figure basically what is now downtown Manhattan. And so the rest of the island was largely unpopulated, although very much owned by large landowners, by farmers, you know, country estates, things like that.
I have to tell you, it's not common that on this show we're choosing books and the illustrations are the things that, you know, instantly tell us we have to do it. But your
that's okay.
Your book contains illustrations that drew me into the story and then I couldn't wait to read it. There are photographs and drawings and paintings of important places in Manhattan at a time when it was literally unrecognizable. Take us back to that time after the Revolutionary War, you know, early 19th century. What sort of place would we find ourselves in strolling around Manhattan Island?
Well, you know, as I said, if we were downtown, we would find ourselves in a haphazard little city. All of these streets generally in that part of in the lower part of the island were essentially laid by the owners of the land where those streets were. The city government was small, relatively powerless, generally, you know, kowtowed to what private interests wanted, and streets got built pretty much where landowners wanted to put them. On the rest of the island, you have basically what the Lenape local natives, who never actually lived on Manhattan, they lived all around it and did some hunting on Manhattan, what they called, and it's the best translation of the word for Manhattan, the Island of Hills. And that's meaningful because it really does describe what Manhattan looked like. It was a very hilly place, and of course, if it's a hilly place, it's also a place of many valleys. And many of those valleys in natural Manhattan had streams running through them at best, at worst, swamps and other bogs. Many of the hills were sort of high and rocky and craggy. And while that was very attractive, say, at the shorelines, and a lot of country estates, for example, were sited there, it made for a somewhat inhospitable place, especially in the middle of the island, you know, for many years.
Why was New York positioned to be the country's preeminent city after the Revolutionary War? Why not Philadelphia or Boston?
Well, let's see. It is around the early 1800s that New York does emerge as the country's first city. Prior to that, and really, you know, even through the Revolution, New York is number three, Philadelphia is number one, Boston's number two, and then New York. It basically has to do with trade. Boston, you know, I'm not a complete expert on this, but you know, generally, New York passes Boston because it's more centrally located. It's a little more south. The harbor is accessible for a little bit more of the year than is Boston's. It's also an incredibly well-protected harbor. And now, you know, flex that back to Philadelphia. Philadelphia's problem is that its harbor is well protected, but it's way upstream from the ocean. And New York's harbor is, you know, uniquely located very close to the ocean and to commercial routes, and yet at the same time very well protected.
So the city government was, I guess, cash poor and land rich around that
time?
There
you go. Yeah, that's right. A large chunk of the island, the island's about 14,000 acres, and about 1,300 acres right in the middle of the island had been granted to the original Dutch government by the Dutch government that was originally controlled New Amsterdam to the local government in New Amsterdam in the 1600s, and that area was called the Waste and Unpatented Lands, commonly known as the Common Lands, meaning it was land owned in common by the entity that was the city government. And that land, roughly speaking, is about where, say, from 3rd Avenue on the east side to 7th Avenue on the west side, and from 23rd Street at the south up to about 90th Street in the north. And if listeners are kind of putting together an image in their head, they'll realize that a big chunk of that land is what later became Central Park. And a big chunk of it is, and this was, you know, undesirable land, a big chunk of it now is 5th Avenue, probably the most pricey bit of real estate in New York.
So they tapped this guy, Casimir Gork. Am I saying that right?
Yeah, Gork. Well, I haven't found any living relatives. So, you know, we can pronounce that however we'd like.
All right, great. and he was charged with, like, dividing up these plots to sell.
Yeah. So in 1785 and then again in 1796, the city commissions Gork, who, by the way, just an asterisk, is married to Elizabeth Roosevelt, a prominent originally Dutch family of New York, and she is, yes, the forebear of the two American presidents. Anyway, the city government tasked Gork with taking these 1,300 acres of undivided common lands and laying them out into lots that might be sold by the city and make some money off its undesirable land. So what Gork does is, between these two surveys, one in the 1780s, one in the 1790s, he lays out three north-south roads, which he calls the East Road and the Middle Road and the West Road. And should we come back in a moment?
Sure. Let's return to the conversation in just a moment. We're speaking this hour with historian Gerard Coppell, author of City on a Grid, How New York Became New York. If you'd like to join our conversation, we have lines open at 1-800-933-5372. You can also email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Spring registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, literature, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
Across 110th Street, woman trying to catch a electric on the stream. You bet it.
That was Bobby Womack singing Across 110th Street. We're speaking this hour with historian Gerard Coppell, author of City on a Grid, How New York Became New York. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. So, Gerard, we have Casimir Gork, who will be a forebear of the Roosevelt presidential family, laying out these five-acre plots.
Yep.
What came of all that?
Okay, so he lays out this east, middle, and west road. He lays out five-acre lots between them. Short end of those lots, the north-south ends, are 260 feet. And he anticipates that 60 of those top feet will one day become streets. And this is the manner in which these lots are sold or attempted to be sold. Well, some of them get sold. The city makes a little bit of money. And then sort of the plan kind of fades away. But lo and behold, just when you thought that that plan was not really going to, you know, had been forgotten, comes along the commissioners, the street commissioners, the planning street planning commissioners appointed in 1807. And what do they come up with after they're at the end of their four-year commission? What plan do they announce? Well, they announce a plan and give no credit to exactly what Gork had done. So East Road becomes 4th Avenue. Middle Road becomes 5th Avenue. West Road becomes 6th Avenue, exactly where Gork had placed them. All those 60-foot-wide streets that never really got built under the Gork plan, lo and behold, those become the 60-foot-wide streets of the commissioner's plan of 1811. And nowhere in the commissioner's explanation of their plan, and by the way, when they announced it in 1811 with a big map, they submitted only an 8-page handwritten report explaining what they had done. Nowhere in any of that do they mention, oh, by the way, we stole the old common lands plan.
How did city leaders come to the conclusion that a unified plan was necessary for Manhattan?
Well, you know, this is another little story. They sort of came to it by accident, as
these things happen.
Many things often happen in cities and you know, with humans generally. In 1803, 4 years after this commission was appointed, another city surveyor, a fellow named Joseph François Magin, M-A-N-G-I-N, now generally pronounced Mangin, he was actually an associate of Gork's as well. He, without being asked to do it, announced a plan for the future development of New York. He had been contracted to make an accurate map of the city as it existed, and instead came up with a map about which he wrote that he was making not a plan of the city as it is, but as it shall be.
It's so poetic.
It is, and he was an educated Frenchman. I believe that those are probably the first written words, if not thoughts, about planning in New York. And he comes up with this plan, announces it in February of 1803. The city government didn't want it, but they loved it. And to make a long story short, by November, it's gone. Why is it gone? Because the street commissioner, which was then a not very important position, it was a one-man office and pretty much rubber-stamped wherever private landowners wanted to put streets. The street commissioner says, wait a minute. You know, what he's done with the southern part of the island, the actual part that he was supposed to do, he's kind of idealized all the streets. He's put water out, streets out to landfill. He's made it look a lot better than it really is. And what he's doing above the settled city, I don't know. This makes no sense. Plan, the Mangin plan, goes away. Now, why did the street commissioner do that? Do we have a moment for this?
Absolutely.
All right. The street commissioner's name was Joseph Brown, with an E, Jr. He was a doctor. Why was he a street commissioner? Well, a few months earlier, he'd been appointed to the commission through the efforts of his appointed as the street commissioner through the efforts of his brother-in-law, everybody's bad boy of the period, Aaron Burr. Aaron Burr appoints, gets his brother-in-law and pal and many nefarious things appointed street commissioner. Well, why is this relevant? it is during 1803 that Brown dispatches Mangan's plan. Well, a few months earlier, in October of 1802, Mangan wins the design competition for City Hall, the current City Hall that we have now, now landmark, you know, iconic image of New York. It was a design competition. The expected winner was a young English-born Philadelphia-based architect named Benjamin Henry Latrobe, the future father of American architecture. He had been guaranteed that he would win the New York City Hall design competition by his sponsor. Any guesses who the sponsor was?
I know who the sponsor was because I read the book, so I'm going to let you give it away.
Okay. It was Aaron Burr. Now, Burr, you see, wanted Latrobe to win that City Hall design competition and relocate to New York. Instead, Burr, who had guaranteed Latrobe in a letter, "All the votes of the common council, the city government, are sewn up but one," quote unquote. Instead, Mangan won by a wide margin, and Latrobe was furious, vowed never to design a building in New York, and he didn't. And Burr, as best I can tell, sought vengeance on Mangan for winning the City Hall design competition, and he used his partner in crime, Joseph Brown, to accomplish it by wrecking Mangan's street map plan.
And yet we have something today that looks a lot like Mangan's plan, don't we?
Well, not really. You know, what Mangan's plan was, what Mangan wanted to do in the as yet unsettled part of the city was essentially segments of rectilinear grid of different densities, meaning some little segments had short and wide streets, some segments had long and narrow streets, and the key is that they were all set at irregular angles to each other. So if you can picture it, in the intersections of all these different grids were all sorts of possibilities for small public parks, for the siting of public buildings, for green space, and also many of these grid segments took advantage of, or at least were cognizant of, the natural surroundings. So where there was a ridge or something like that, that would be the edge of a grid. And it would have, so if Burr had not influenced Brown to get rid of Mangan's plan, what we might have had today, if Mangan's plan had gone forward, and when he proposed it in early February 1803, the city government loved it. They considered it the future map of the city. But once it went away, if we had continued with that map, if that had gone into effect, you can see how we might have had a city that looks sort of like an American Paris or a bit of European sophistication adapted to this narrow, rocky island. And instead, what we have really is actually the opposite of it. The grid plan or the street plan that the commissioners came up with in 1811 is really a relentless rectilinear grid with no breaks in it. And, for example, people may be saying, hey, well, what about Central Park? Wasn't in the plan. What about Broadway, which cuts across most of the plan? Wasn't in the plan. Which cuts across the city now? Wasn't in the plan.
I like this. You say that a rectilinear grid favors private interest over public convenience, which is no small thing. The arrangement maximizes private space, you know, available for buildings or whatever, but eliminates the kinds of, and you mentioned Broadway just now, the kinds of diagonal routes that regular people take to save time.
You know, there's an image in the book, and actually it's the narrative opens with a description of this image. And it's a photograph taken in 1882 from the roof of a new mansion at what was still called 4th Avenue and 94th Street, soon to be called renamed Park Avenue. And it shows, looking south, the approaching grid. The grid is filling in now. It's 1882, 1883. You can see the rectilinear streets have been built. The rectilinear buildings have been built. So essentially beginning the replication of the rectilinearity from the horizontal plane into the vertical plane. And yet in the foreground is still an empty lot, a big empty lot between 92nd and 93rd Streets. And what do you see in that lot? I mean, you know that there are going to be buildings there soon, but what do you see in that lot? What you see very, very faintly are two footpaths in the dirt of that lot, and they are diagonals. And why are they there? Because the people who are in that neighborhood want to get to where they're going as quickly as possible. And the quickest way to get somewhere is not around two legs of a triangle, but along one leg, which in many cases is just a simple diagonal. And that that image really, in a sense, tells the story of the grid and the book, is that by imposing this rectilinearity on the island, a certain humaneness or humanity was lost. And I'm not saying the grid is a bad thing. I'm just saying that we have this incredibly powerful rectilinear form, which you know, in many ways helped New York grow into such a powerful place. But at the same time, we have a loss of this more naturalistic form, where building structures would have to conform to irregularities in a street plan, whether they're diagonals or serpentines or circles.
It sounds almost indulgent until you think that, you know, literally millions of people will spend their lives there and be affected by this. Did anyone care about whether the city would be beautiful?
Well, this is, probably the greatest issue that I have with the grid. And, you know, I'm not really a grid hater. there are plenty of them, you know. I mean, the list of grid haters is long, right? You know, Walt Whitman, Edgar Allan Poe, Henry James, Edith Wharton, all sorts of Frederick Law Olmsted, who designed Central Park, hated the grid. I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought there.
Who cared whether it would be beautiful?
Oh, yeah. Well, all those people I mentioned did care that it was not beautiful. And, you know, the sense of beauty in urban form goes all the way back to Aristotle, who felt that rectilinear cities were good, but it was essential that they have a component of beauty to make them essentially livable. And the commissioners, the three commissioners who came up with their plan in 1811, for them, beauty was simply not in the equation. It actually, the word does not appear anywhere in their relatively short document explaining their actions.
How did it happen that the streets in Manhattan were mostly named by number?
Well, that's basically what the commissioners decided. I guess it was just easy. Again, they didn't necessarily explain it. They just said, we will start at the southern limit of their authority was what is now Houston Street on the east side, and Greenwich Village, which had already been established as a separate village, the northern limits of Greenwich Village on the west side. Houston Street then was called North Street for a reason. It was basically the northernmost street where anybody lived. But they were given authority from that point all the way up to the tip of the island. And in fact, they quit at 155th Street. They just said, okay, streets 1 through 155, avenues 1 through 12. And again, they didn't really say why. I think it was just easy. It was sort of like a Cartesian vision of X and Y planes with just a bunch of numbers on them.
All right. So if you're going to overlay a grid on this, you know, piece of territory, you're going to need a lot of land that you haven't had access to before. Can you talk about the kind of authority that the commission had to sort of exercise eminent domain on which to build these streets?
Well, now, that's sort of a two-part answer. The commissioners, appointed 1807, their plan in 1811, they were given ultimate authority. They were empowered by a state law to come up with whatever plan they wanted. There was no direction about, you know, what sort of plan they could make. They could have come up with an island of spirals if they wanted to. The minimum was 50-foot wide streets, and that's it. Okay, so their authority there is complete. And in fact, because the law was so strongly written, even though landowners for many decades afterwards fought in the courts, practically all of them lost because the grid law was sacrosanct. Now, after that, and, you know, the commission goes out of commission in 1811, but in fact, all they've done is put a map, a crosshatch of lines over an incredibly naturalistically varied island. How is that going to be implemented? Well, that wasn't their problem. That was the problem of the guy who had served as their surveyor, a guy named John Randall, Jr., R-A-N-D-E-L. He stuck around for another 10 years, now not as an employee of the commissioners, but as an employee of the city, and actually implemented the plan, meaning he made a very large-scale, very small-scale maps showing the details of where every street had to go. And, for example, a street showing that a street might have a farmhouse sitting in the middle of it, or a stream running through it, or a pond in the middle of it. Well, all those things had to go. And eventually they did. And oftentimes landowners objected, but pretty much every time they were rejected. And the houses were moved, the ponds were buried. And as a general rule, the hills of Manhattan were dumped into the valleys to flatten the thing out and make it a suitable place for this large rectilinear grid.
And it really didn't matter who you were. If your house was in the way, it was going to be moved or raised.
That is right. Rich or poor, and mostly rich, really, because it was mostly wealthy who owned upstate land, up island lands, and they all lost in the end.
Historian Gerard Coppell is my guest. His new book is called City on a Grid: How New York Became New York. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter. I'm at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Spring registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, literature, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with historian Gerard Coppell. We're talking about his new book, City on a Grid: How New York Became New York. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Gerard, was the grid demonstrably good for business in Manhattan?
Well, I think you'd have to say yes. in a word.
Immediately,
my answers tend to be long, but that was a short answer, okay? you know, what it did was make what was a potentially confusing island, as the southern tip was, as even the village of Greenwich was, and to some extent still is, and made it an orderly, rational place. The streets were straight. The avenues were straight. They were at relatively equal distance from each other. And it was easy for, at first, many land speculators, notably, of course, John Jacob Astor, who everybody thinks got really rich in the fur trading business. But in fact, he became the richest American by investing in up island land in the 1820s and 1830s after the grid plan had been announced. It was absolutely, the grid was a boon to development and to commercial development and to the sense of New York as a powerful, rational, money-making place.
Of course, more development, more business, more people means more traffic. And this was a problem even before people were getting around in automobiles, but that was certainly a big change.
Yeah, I think the great problem with the grid is that there are too many streets and they're too narrow, and there are too few avenues and they're not quite wide enough, and of course there aren't any diagonals to move people more efficiently. But I think, and you know, maybe long past the time that we can do anything about it, but it sure would be nice if instead of 12 avenues, there might be 24, and instead of so many streets, perhaps fewer. And it would have made movement on the island in automobiles, I think, much easier. You know, and on the other hand, of course, if we had gotten Mangan's plan with these sort of broken up grids, the automobile may never actually have flourished on Manhattan. And, you know, we might have had much more mass transportation as other less gridded places have. But these straight streets and avenues seemed initially very hospitable to the automobile, and then, boom, there are just way too many automobiles, and anybody who spent any time trying to get around Manhattan in a car or a taxi or even a bus, midweek, and especially now, like, you know, holiday season, knows that there's just something not really working very well here.
So there have been some crazy ideas proposed over the years to relieve that congestion, none of which worked much better than what was finally implemented.
Well, you know, there were we can think of Lexington and Madison Avenues, for example. They were not in the original plan. They were added in the 1830s, and they actually add a little bit more movement in that area rather than the vast distance between 3rd and 4th Avenue and 4th and 5th Avenues, which is 920 feet. It's still 920 feet between 5th Avenue and 6th Avenue. But in 1910, the mayor, among many plans for modifying the grid, the mayor then, William J. Gaynor, he proposed, front page of the Sunday New York Times magazine, a new avenue, splitting 5th and 6th, Avenue 5 1/2. Going all the way from Greenwich Village up to Central Park. And that was a remarkable plan. It would have, by that time, 1910, chopped through an incredibly dense city. And needless to say, many landowners and building owners were furious with him. A couple of months after proposing this plan, he got shot. Not by angry real estate barons, but in fact by a disgruntled and recently fired dock worker who thought that Gaynor was responsible for his having been fired, and that was kind of the end of what was called Gaynor's Avenue. But there have been so many other plans over the years. Numerous people have suggested diagonals. For example, in the same year that Gaynor's plan was proposed, 1910, somebody else proposed running a diagonal from the Queensboro Bridge. I hope listeners sort of roughly understand what that is, the sort of midtown on the east side. A diagonal from there to Penn Station, which was then new. That would have been a massive diagonal cutting right through the middle of the island. I mean, it's a fascinating idea, and the diagrams for it were really incredible. They're in the book. That, of course, you know, didn't go anywhere either. And really what happened is by the time the grid is filled in and pretty much all the streets are built by about the 1890s and the city fills in rapidly after that, there's just no way to get rid of all the structures that are already there.
What were Frederick Law Olmsted's guiding principles in designing Central Park?
Olmsted is great because I'll read you a quote from Olmsted. Calvert Vaux, V-A-U-X, the two of them won the design competition for Central Park in the 1850s. And the reason, of course, that there was a competition to create a park is that people suddenly realize, oh, my God, we are going to have a incredibly dense island with no green relief. And fortunately, there were some forward-thinking people in the early 1850s just as the gridded streets are sort of approaching the area of what would become Central Park, who said, look, we need to lay, we need to keep this area from being gridded. We need to build a big park here. Anyway, Olmsted and Vaux win the design competition. Olmsted, here's what he wrote in 1858 to one of the commissioners who was in charge of building the park. He wrote, quote, "The time will come when New York will be built up, when all the grading and filling will be done, when the picturesquely varied rock formations of the island will have been converted into the foundations for rows of monotonous straight streets and piles of erect angular buildings."
It's like he had a crystal ball.
There will be no suggestion left of its present varied surface, with the single exception of the few acres contained in the park. Well, in fact, the park has about 873 acres. But what anybody who's been to Central Park will notice is there is not a right angle in it. Everything is serpentine, curvilinear, even the bridge shapes, the roadways. There's one diagonal, the mall, and that's about it. And really what Olmsted created was the anti-grid center of New York, sort of the anti-urban urban center of New York. And it is a non-rectilinear place. The great irony, of course, is that the shape of Central Park, its outer boundary, is a rectangle. And so you have this sort of anti-griddiness all running around inside a great rectangular space anyway.
Well, you had to make it fit in with all those surrounding blocks, I guess.
Exactly, exactly. Now, Olmsted, you know, that was Olmsted's first design. He went on to design, you know, dozens of fantastic parks all over America, not one of them, I believe, with a rectilinear outer boundary.
What did you learn about how planners in other cities around America, across the world, responded to what had happened in Manhattan? How did they take ideas from that? How did they use it as a sign of what to do or what not to do?
I think what the grid did for New York in terms of Europeans is that it gave Europeans a sense that America and its leading city, New York, could be an orderly place. I mean, you know, the grid is created in the early 1800s. This is still a vastly unsettled nation, unsettled continent, and here is this great orderly form. And I think that conveyed a sense to Europeans that America might actually straighten itself out as the years went on. In America itself, as Western settlement went forward, I think the New York City grid gave empowered other city planners that to think that a grid would work for their developments as it worked in Manhattan. And, you know, so many other cities are laid out on grids, you know, after New York, Chicago, you know, especially, but many, many others. Now, of course, in those areas, you had, for the most part, flatlands that extended out, you know, for as far and wide as a city wanted to be, not a narrow rocky island. But somehow the gridding of Manhattan, I think, conveyed an orderly power that other city founders and planners wanted to emulate.
Is there any reason to think that the grid works better, given that the city did have to grow so far up, that there wasn't space to expand? I mean, certainly there are suburbs and there are the other boroughs, but really everything on Manhattan had to go straight up.
You know, as I think I said a little bit earlier, the 1811 commissioners decided to quit at 155th Street. They had the power to go all the way up to what is now, you know, up into the 230s. They didn't go beyond 155th because that was really hilly and rocky. And they said, you know, we'll just quit here because it will be centuries before the rest of the island is settled. And I think they were kind of
they were off.
I think they were giving themselves an excuse because they realized that if they gridded all the way up to the northern tip, there was no way that the plan could work up there. And in fact, In the beginning in the 1860s or so, people start thinking about, okay, what are we going to do above 155th? And what we got there was actually a very, very modified grid that is very naturalistic. Many of the streets are curvilinear. They follow natural contours. And you get a sense above 155th of what Manhattan might have looked like if you take it all the way back, if Aaron Burr hadn't sicked Joseph Brown on Joseph Mangan's plan. I think Manhattan could have worked as a differently organized place. You know, it's this great question and egg, you know, question. You know, did the grid convey the necessary power to make Manhattan a powerful place, or is Manhattan going to be a powerful place anyway, and the grid just helped it along? Don't know.
The city, you know, if you go today as a visitor, it feels very permanent. I wonder, as a historian and also as a native New Yorker, if you have a different sense of things, if you walk around sort of picturing in your mind what was once there.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, Manhattan is not a complete flatland now. There are still hills that have been, you know, much, much lowered from what they originally were. But you can stand on portions of Second Avenue and other portions of the city looking up and down the avenues, and you can get a sense of how the place looked originally. But, you know, cities develop. You know, you can't have a densely occupied, commercially active place without reshaping it to the needs of the place. You know, if you don't reshape it very much, then you may not really get very much of a city. So anybody who walks the streets, certainly you're overwhelmed by all the right angles, and you try to, some people, as I do, try to find ways to, like, go through building lobbies or go through the relatively few parks to sort of have a little bit of non-gritty experience. For many people, you know, the grid is comforting. You do know where you're going. You do know as a general which direction you're going in. And so, you know, it's this, I think, constant tension. And I suppose constant tension is a good thing for anywhere, but especially an active urban place.
The new book by historian Gerard Coppell is called City on a Grid: How New York Became New York. Gerard, thank you so much for making this time for us.
Chris, thank you very much.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered today by Justin Martin. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phones from Gus Contreras. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.